But there were thousands of other cases in the files, not as well known to the general public because of the reluctance of the press to cover them and because the challenge to Air Force secrecy had not become as strong. Webb also was familiar with the findings and research of the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization in Tucson, Arizona, another conservative non-profit group, inclined to take more seriously the reports of intelligent beings associated with UFO sightings, where the craft hovered or landed. APRO, as the organization is known, is under the direction of L.J. Lorenzen, an engineer in the Kitt Peak National Observatory at Tucson. Among its advisors are Dr. Frank Salisbury, professor of plant physiology at Colorado State University, Dr. R. Leo, 39, Sprinkle, assistant professor of psychology at the University of Wyoming, Ming, H. C. Dudley, chairman and professor of physics, University of Southern Mississippi, Dr. James A. Harder, associate professor in the College of Engineering, University of California, Berkeley, and others. Dr. Dudley once said, "I recommend we use a bit of scientific curiosity to see whatever is the physics of the phenomena so many people are describing as UFOs. Ascribing the phenomena as due to psychological aberration is nonsense. There is a series of physical phenomena that needs explaining. Let's get on with it in an open-minded, scientifically oriented manner. Then let the data provide the answer." Dr. Harder, OF, the University of California, added, "I think the evidence for the reality of unidentified flying objects is beyond a reasonable doubt, and that the phenomena is deserving of scientific attention in spite of the existence of organizations on the lunatic fringe that have tended to discredit such attention." Among the organizations to which members of APRO's advisory staff are associated are the American Physical Society, the American Psychological Association, the National Science Foundation, the National Institute of Health, and NASA. Among the APRO reports, documented in the book by Coral Lorenzen, The Great Flying Saucer Hoax, William Frederick Press, 1962, Walter Webb found an unusual series of sightings investigated by Dr. Olavo Fons, in Brazil. Dr. Fons, the APRO representative in that country, is a medical doctor, and first vice president of the Brazilian Society of Gastroenterology and Nutrition. Webb discovered in Dr. Fons' reports that the village of Ponta Piran, Brazil, had been the scene of a strange series of UFO experiences over a period of 2.5 months, from December 1, 1957 to March 1, 1958. They interested Webb in relation to the Hill case because of the persistent tendency of the objects to trail and follow individuals and vehicles, much in the same nature as the object in New Hampshire had followed the Hills. For the most part, the objects in Brazil were Saturn-shaped, a shape often described in UFO sightings, along with the saucer and cigar shapes more commonly noted. During this extended time period, the objects buzzed jeeps and cars, mostly along the lonely roads near Ponta Piran. The actions of the objects were interpreted as a probe to discover human reactions to their presence. The INCIDENT in Car Ponta Piran, on the southwestern frontier of Forte, Brazil, a landscape consisting of a forest-covered plateau known as Mato Grosso, was the first one recorded. It was approximately 6:30 in the evening of December 1, 1957, when a farm woman, her driver and servant, and three young sons were driving toward the town in a jeep. Two glowing objects, flying side by side, approached them and glided along the side of the road, oscillating in a strange wobbling motion. They were described as metallic spheres, about 15 feet in diameter, encircled by a rotating ring. The upper half of the objects was fiery red, the lower, silvery white. Each gave off a blinding glare, with variable intensity. For 2 full hours the objects followed the jeep, darting ahead of it and around it in circles. In the 2 times the driver stopped the jeep, one of the objects came down to just above the ground, while the other hovered high in the air. When the jeep entered Ponta Piran, both objects climbed into the sky and disappeared. On February 1, 2 sightings were made near the town, One of them at 4:00 a.m., the other at 1:30 p.m. The early morning sighting involved the same family, this time with the object dropping down over the road and hovering in front of a Jeep, its red glow dimming and turning to a silvery color. The people in the Jeep were afraid, as Barney Hill had been in the field near Indian Head, that they were in imminent danger of being captured. The driver turned around and sped back to the village, where the object climbed to a high altitude and hovered over the town for half an hour longer. Six other witnesses were rounded up, and the group loaded into two Jeeps to drive out to the lonely section of the road where the UFO had first been spotted. The object followed them, but remained at a distance, again climbing to a high altitude. It was not until 6:00 a.m. that it shot upward at tremendous speed and disappeared. That night, four highly respected citizens of the town, including a professor, a law student, a notary and a tax clerk, went to the location on the road where the object had first hovered so low. At 10:30 the brilliant reddish object approached them from the sky, oscillating from side to side. When another object appeared to join it, the group panicked and drove back to town. On March 3 a similar incident took place, with the object finally hovering a few feet above the road in front of the Jeep. When the driver tried to ram it, it shot straight up and disappeared. Interestingly, over a dozen strikingly similar accounts to these were recorded in Exeter, New Hampshire, and many other locations in the United States in 1965-66. 41. What interested Webb was that these stories, and many others like them in both NICAP and APRO records, were close parallels to the Hill case, yet they had occurred in different parts of the world, and none knew of the other's experiences. On November 2, 1961, Webb wrote the Hills to thank them for their cooperation, indicating that he had submitted his extensive report to NICAP. None of the three knew at that time that there was to be an other even more extensive report by Webb that would far exceed his first in interest and impact. About a month before Webb filed his NICAP report, Robert Hoffman, a staff scientific writer on both engineering and science for one of the world's most notable corporations in the electronic industry, and C.D. Jackson, a senior engineer for the same company, went to Washington to attend the 12th International Astronautical Congress as part of their regular routine. Both had been deeply involved in work on the space program and were preparing a paper on three experimental scientists of previous years, Nikola Tesla, David Todd, and Marconi, the acknowledged father of radio. Their paper was to examine the original data of these scientists in response to a rhetorical inquiry by the Office of the Director of Defense Research and Engineering. What research is being done to keep abreast of the scientific advances of the past? To see that there is not needless duplication of effort? The paper presented evidence and deductive scientific reasoning to indicate that Tesla, Todd and Marconi observed laboratory data and related phenomena that suggested the possibility that they were monitoring interplanetary communications during the period of 1899 to 1924. They also noted that during the same period exactly, the Russian theorist Konstantin Tsiolkovsky deduced a model of an intelligence existing independently of terrestrial influence. The paper examined the possibility of identical radio signals in this time span, emanating from Tau Ceti celestial body 1.18 liters IT years away. Aztec HNICINS work in advanced fields of science, both Hoffman, A. and Jackson were interested in the data being accumulated on the UFO subject by NICAP, and arranged to HRVLUNCH with their major keyholder, being the Astroenergetical Congress. Hoffman happened to mention to THE Major that he had not heard of many recent UFO reports and wondered if the ENT phenomenon were dropping in frequency. Major Kyo brought up the LTTER and ICAP H had just received from the HILS, 10F their, 42, organization's most interesting cases in many months. Hoffman and Jackson were at once interested, but the story seemed so incredible that they were cautious in accepting it. On the other hand, if there were any truth to the story, they wanted to investigate it with an open mind. They debated the idea for several weeks and finally got in touch with Walter Webb, who had just completed his report. He sent them a copy, and they studied it carefully. Knowing of Webb's reputation for accuracy, they were considerably impressed. His appraisal of the character and competence of the Hills led them to take immediate action. On November 3, 1961, they wrote the Hills, "Dear Mr. and Mrs. Hill, this letter will introduce Mr. C.D. Jackson and myself. Our interest in writing you at this time concerns your recent experience of September 1, 1961. Your participation in this event was brought to our attention by Major National Astronautical Congress, Washington, D.C., on October 4 to the 5th, 1961, and more specifically, Boston area. Whereas our principal interest in this subject is concerned with the attempt to verify the origin of these vehicles according to existing scientific theory maintained by Professor Hermann Oberth, of Germany, there is, naturally, a similar interest in trying to determine as well, the meaning of the whole phenomenon. Your own recent experience might offer some help in this latter regard. Mr. Jackson and I would like to visit with you at a time and place convenient to you. We are mature people associated with a major electronics and engineering corporation. Our discussion would be entirely objective. Having a close familiarity with most of the unclassified, military, literature assistance in answering your questions, as well as continuing our own investigation on this subject. For the purpose of scheduling, we would be able to visit in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, during the week of November 1, 3, 1961, preferably the 1/8/19th of that week. Sincerely yours, IS/Robert E. Hoffman. Dealing with this subject, and dating back to 1947, we would like to be of Donald Kehoe, with whom we had luncheon during the recent 12 inter, through Mr. Webb, NICAP representative IN there. Hoffman and Jackson were not able to get together with the Hills at their Horn in Portsmouth until a week beyond their suggested date. But on November 25, they arrived to review the story of the strange experience. Visiting the Hills at the time was Major James McDonald, 43, an Air Force intelligence officer who had just recently retired from active duty, and a close friend of the Hills. Later, in 1962, Barney and Betty Hill were to stand up for the Major when he was married to one of Betty's close friends and associates in her welfare work. Further, when NICAP made additional inquiry about the character and reliability of the Hills, Major McDonald was to give them an unqualified recommendation. The Grew Betty and Barney Hill, Robert Hoffman, C.D. Jackson and Major McDonald less than onferred for another long session, beginning at noon and running almost until midnight. The Hills were impressed by the businesslike and professional attitude of Hoffman and Jackson, with Barney again reflecting surprise that so much attention was being directed toward a subject he still had lingering doubts about, in spite of his own traumatic experience. Hoffman and Jackson inquired about many facets in the case that puzzled Barney, particularly an inquiry as to whether there were any nitrates or nitrate derivatives in the Hills car. "The only thing I could think of that possibly had some connection with nitrates," Barney later said, "was gunpowder. I did have about a dozen shotgun shells in the car, left over from a trip to the south when I had practiced shooting at tin cans on my uncle's farm, but aside from that, I couldn't think of anything." The reason they were asking, they said, was that in several close UFO encounters, the people had been in rural areas where they were exposed to nitrates or nitrate fertilizer. "Then it hit us, Betty had left the bone meal fertilizer in the trunk of the car before the trip, and I hadn't bothered to take it out. Now who knows? Maybe it does have significance, maybe it doesn't. It was interesting that they should bring it up, when we had forgotten all about it. And they asked a lot of questions that started me thinking questions like, did we have anything new in the car, any new object, and had it disappeared?" There had been reports, apparently, of people having close sightings, and something they had recently purchased, had disappeared. They asked if anything had disappeared out of our car, but this was 2 months later, and we had a lot of junk in there. I couldn't remember. One of the questions they did ask was, why did we take the trip? This might seem to an unrealistic question. But in thinking on it, it's not too far-fetched. Number 1, there was no preparation for the trip. I had gone to Boston that night and had worked and was returning to Portsmouth that day. I decided during work, well, I think I would, 44, like to go to Niagara Falls and then return via Montreal. Betty had the week off anyway, and I was able to call in and get an extension of the weekend for several days. So we packed our car that night. Betty Hill's comments are similar. This was how impulsive it was. The only money we had was in our pockets. Saturday the banks were closed so we couldn't even cash a check. I think the amount between the two of us was less than $70. So the questions they asked were interesting, mainly because we had never thought along those lines. They provoked a lot of thought in both of us, mentioning the remote possibilities of life existing on planets involved with Alpha Centauri or Tau Ceti, which was news to me. I don't think I've ever heard of them. Their questions were so far out that I just couldn't see what relationship they had to our experience. And this business of nitrates. At that time, I had all kinds of plants in the house. In fact, in the living room, I had an avocado tree that touched the ceiling. They walked around, looked my plants over and asked me what kind of fertilizer I used on them and things like this. And while they were here they were mentally reconstructing the whole trip. One of them said, "What took you so long to get home?" They said, "Look, you went this distance and it took you these hours. Where were you?" Well, when they said this, I thought I was really going to crack up. I got terrified, and I even put my head on the table. And I went back over the trip in my mind, recalling, or trying to recall that vague moment when it looked as if the moon had been on the ground. They tried to reconstruct that time sequence, and they said, you couldn't have seen the moon on the ground at the time, because apparently at that period, they knew what time the moon had set that night. And the moon had set fairly early. It just wouldn't tie in with this time business. They suggested that we check and find just where the moon sat at the time, because it apparently wasn't the moon that we saw or thought we saw. Then this whole lapse of time business, too, I really became upset about that. I became suddenly flabbergasted, Barney added in his words, to think that I realized for the first time that at the rate of speed I always travel, we should have arrived home at least 2 hours earlier than we did. Normally, for me to travel from Colebrook to here we know we left at 1:05 that night actually takes less than 4 hours, even figuring out the period of time we stopped on the highway and at no time did we stop for more than 5 minutes. I was baffled as to what, 45, the reason was for us leaving Colebrook at 1:05 p.m. and AMVMC back here at dawn, somewhere around 5:00 a.m. nearly 7 hours instead of less than 4. Even if I allowed more time than I know we took at those roadside stops, there still were at least 2 hours missing out of that night's trip. To the entire group in the Hill living room that afternoon, the missing time period became a major mystery. The Hills tried but simply could not account for it. Nor could they account for the 35 miles between Indian Head and Ashland, during which their recollection amounted to almost nothing. They were now more puzzled and confused than ever. For the first time it fully dawned on them that they were facing a period of simultaneous amnesia, experienced by each of them at the same time, falling roughly between the first series of beeps that emanated from the back of their car and the second series of beeps they encountered somewhere near Ashland, 35 miles to the south. The thought that plagued everyone at the meeting was that while it was unusual enough for one person to be struck suddenly with a temporary period of amnesia, it was very strange for two intelligent people to experience it together under such fantastic conditions. As a hard-headed former intelligence officer in the Air Force, Major J. Ames MacDonald groped for some kind of answer to the puzzle. UFOs are constantly being discussed in the Air Force, much more so than the laconic official statements from the Pentagon indicate. Officially, the AIR force position requires that no member of the force can report any incidents to the public. All information must be channeled through the Foreign Technology Division at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Ohio, and in TUM. Any release of that information can only be made by the Office of the Secretary of the AIR Force at the Pentagon. The factory MINS that many Air Force pilots and radar men do talk, and those who have directly come in contact with the objects revise stories of INC-readable speeds, right-angle turns, and maneuvers that are impossible to duplicate by any aircraft canown to the military. Even the most sophisticated weapons were said to have been used in an attempt to bring the UFOs down without success. Major McNay LD had no direct experience with the subject of UFOs in HISAIR Force career, but he had a profound respect for it. He felt that it was a subject he viewed with an open mind, each case considered on its own merits, and that only first-hand accounts had any value. He was also aware that many reports of UFOs consisted of an 46 observers' honest mistakes, perhaps by confusing shooting stars, Venus, shadows on a windshield, or street Elmo's fire, with unidentified craft. On the other hand, he was aware of the many cases involving technically qualified people of impeccable character whose close encounters with the objects were clearly observed and unexplainable in conventional aerodynamic terms. He realized the complete probability of the phenomena, that the valid reports were by no means unrealistic or absurd, and that extraterrestrial life was not only possible but entirely probable. Space programs on the Earth included impact landings on Venus and a soft landing on the Moon, so why couldn't the reverse process be taking place? He was fascinated by the probe that Hoffman and Jackson were conducting, impressed by their attention to detail and their posing of interesting and imponderable questions. But most critical of all, what happened in the 2 hours when the Hills suffered double amnesia? What could have happened? What did happen? When the discussion focused on this critical point, the problem narrowed down to finding a way of discovering what happened during the missing time period, a way to penetrate the unyielding curtain that began to descend when Barney Hill looked through the binoculars and came down completely when the first series of beeps sounded in the speeding car. What was missing was not only the 2 hours of time but a distance of 35 miles, for which there was little accounting. It was at this point in the informal gathering that Major McDonald suggested the possibility of medical hypnosis. He had, during his Air Force career, become somewhat familiar with the subject and was impressed with its valid use under controlled medical conditions. He was also aware of its dangers in the hands of stage hypnotists or other inexperienced people. He knew that hypnotherapy and hypnoanalysis had been used in cases involving amnesia, producing some strikingly dramatic results in the rehabilitation of servicemen suffering from war neuroses, sometimes described as battle fatigue or shell shock. In a sense, he reasoned, the Hills had experienced a violent trauma much like shell shock, a condition that often produced temporary amnesia which had frequently been treated successfully by medical hypnosis. When Major McDonald suggested hypnosis, the group was immediately interested. Hoffman and Jackson by now had no doubts about the character and competence of the Hills, but they were aware that, 47, this strange case needed further documentation. Major McDonald, who had discussed the case many times with the Hills, was convinced of their sincerity and anxious to help them overcome the nagging doubts and fears. On several occasions, Barney had said to McDonald, "Jim, how do I know that this thing happened? How do I know that I wasn't just seeing things? I'm in this terrible position where I really do know it happened, and I can't get myself to believe it. It's bugging me so seriously that my ulcers are kicking up, just at the point where they were getting better." It was agreed that the idea of medical hypnosis was a good one, but the problem became one of finding the proper medical man to take the case, or if, indeed, he thought it was wise to do so. Obviously, the case should not be entrusted to any but the most competent psychiatric specialist, but no one immediately came to mind. Hoffman, Jackson, and Major McDonald agreed to make inquiries, and the Hills, Both felt the idea had merit. I agreed with the idea wholeheartedly, Betty later said. Because the moment they suggested hypnosis, I thought of my dreams, and this was the first time I began to wonder if they were more than just dreams. Then, I really got upset over my dreams. I thought, well now, if I have hypnosis, I'll know one way or the other because this was, I thought God, will map my dreams as something that really happened. I also thought, about that strange experience while driving with Bianni in the car when he slowed down for the other car standing in the road. I really panicked at that Timmy. And when hypnosis was suggested, I thought of this incident too. And I thought to myself, why did I react in this way? I've never done that before in my life. My reaction to the hypnosis idea, Barney added, was, first, what, the effects of hypnosis? What is it about? The experience of it. What, will I feel like going under? I was mildly reluctant, without saying so, to submit myself to such a thing. Unless it was for me own I could HRVCOMPLET confidence in. But what overruled my apprehension about that was the though TONCEN for all times, this might clear up Betty and her NONSNSEABOUT her dreams. I further thought that the hypnosis PROCSMIGHTALSO explain the mental blockage I had at Indian Head and that WHOLET repeat to be missing for the 35 miles from I and Diana lead to Ashland. So I felt that this could be something I would get AFULLUNTLCRSTANDING about. And of course it would clear up UTYSD REAMS TO the point that for once and for all, I could say, look, Nip Betty, they are dreams. They have nothing whatever to do with the UFO sighting. You see, Betty kept wondering about what happened between the two series of beeps. I didn't think anything happened between the two. All I thought was that it would get me beyond that point of standing on the highway, looking at these moving figures in the craft. The one that kept looking back at me with those eyes. He gave me the impression, and this was dim in my memory, but the just the same he was a very capable person, and there can be no nonsense here. We have Boosie Nest to attend to. These were all thoughts going through my mind. As to how this person was affecting me, I wanted to get beyond that point. And this was the reason that Jim McDonald's suggestion appealed to me. It was to be some time before the Hills were able to follow up the suggestion. In the meantime, the compulsion grew in both of them that they must return to the scene of the incident, as Walter Webb had suggested, and relive the experience trying to recapture the elusive shreds of memory. 1/I/149, Chapter 4. It wasn't until after the holidays that the Hills were able to think about returning to the scene of the encounter. The inevitable Christmas bustle helped suspend their lingering doubts and questions, if only on a temporary basis. Finally, in February of 1962, a series of pilgrimages began that were to continue for many months, in all seasons. At first they would go two or three times a month, later, they were to skip many weeks at a time. But always with the same questions to answer: what happened during the inexplicable bear lookout? Where did Barney spin the car off to a side road? And, if he did, what happened? The idea of hypnosis was temporarily tabled. Neither Hoffman, Jack's son, nor Major McDonald could suggest a psychiatrist, and Betty, especially, hoped that the return trips to the area might spark a chain of memory that would suddenly bring back their recall. Again, Barney was ambivalent about taking the trips. Betty could overcome Barney's resistance by suggesting they look for a new and different restaurant on each trip, a particular weakness of his. They would often pack a lunch to economize on the trip up, so that they later could splurge at dinner. Or they might leave Portsmouth at 3:00 in the afternoon on a Saturday, derive a long route 4 toward Concord, then swing northerly on the expressway, planning to reach Route 3 at dusk. They reasoned that after dark the area would be as it was the night of the encounter, the land, So, scape more provoking to their senses if they were to discover the vaguely defined road that they half recalled from the limbo period of their amnesia.